Bla 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 cha cha cha. And this is called a bla bla cha cha cha. Having words to fit is true, so you just say bla bla cha cha cha.
A spectator. Get up and dance. What's that? Your head says yes, but your sore joints say no way? Oh, not like you to stay on the sidelines, pal.
Stumble up the stairway, shuffle down the hall. These aching joints are sore.
You don't have to take joint pain sitting down. For sore hips, knees, shoulders, elbows, even ankles, wrists, and back, new treatments and surgical procedures can restore joints and help get you back in the game.
The joints don't jump no more. The joints don't jump no more.
To find out how to keep healthy joints healthy and make sore joints feel good again, visit orthoinfo.org. A public service message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons.
The joints ain't sore no more.
I still got it.
Yes, marhaban, في music for human. I am a doctor, جالس السكران. And I welcome you. Today in the sidereal calendar, it is the 8th and 20th of the 8th month, bringing us in alignment with Venus. But in the Islamic calendar, it is today the 7th day of Ramadan, which means that many Muslims are fasting today. And so during the air, the sun will be setting during the program this evening. And to indicate the time when Muslims should break their fast, we'll be playing the following sound. Symbolizing the moment when Muslims are permitted to drink for the first time since dawn today. But that won't happen for another 28 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, a while. But happy Ramadan. Well, I have with me tonight Professor Levine. Professor, welcome.
It's a very wide pleasure of mine to be present.
Is it? It is wide, but not deep.
Well, it is deep, but I believe its width is greater than its depth today.
You take pleasure in both depth and width.
And today is a broadly pleasurable day.
Pleasurable, that is, in many ways, but none of them are on many levels.
That's correct.
The facets of your enjoyment are multifaceted.
There are multi, yes, and many.
Whereas my pleasure in having you here is a deep pleasure.
That's interesting.
And somewhat a long pleasure. Well, anyway, once again, welcome Professor Levine. Professor Levine is a professor of Jewish mysticism.
With a New Age emphasis, of course.
Of course. We also have with us Frau Dr. Zina van Kuchen. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
It is wonderful having you. Dr. Van Kuchen is an expert on neologistics.
Yes, I'm bringing Marxian neologism into the New Age.
And what is neologism?
It's a thinking together of the old and new with an emphasis on language. I create new sounds and collections of phonemes from the existing linguistic apparatus in order to further a project of historical materialism and pushing history forward.
Now, Professor or Doctor, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe neologism comes from two Greek roots, neo meaning new, and the logos referring to physical and carnal pleasure.
I don't believe that that is the meaning of logos. That may be one of the meanings, but it can also mean a kind of logic, or logic in the terms of language or symbology and signs. I'm concerned more with the after effects of semiotics and structuralism and how we can make Marxian interventions in the aftermath of these ways of thinking about language. Neologism has come to mean a word that is created anew. Of course, words are never born in a vacuum. Language is culture, and with language we have so many associations and connotations that a single sound is never, it's never unique. It's always been said before.
But I wonder, sure, words can be neologisms, but can a person be a neologism?
I think that if we consider life as a work of art, and art as
work
culture, and language, then of course a person could be a conduit of neologism or live a neologistic lifestyle.
Because my guru used to tell me a lot that I have a neologistical soul.
I believe you do.
That is to say, a soul which has been recreated as a word?
No, a soul which is a rebirth of the old in a new guise.
Well, there are many founding myths of this world which argue or present the world as created through language. Plato, for one, describes the world being created through language. I'm sure there, you know, maybe you could speak to the Jewish tradition.
Yes, in the Jewish tradition it's said that the world was created with ten words or ten statements, referring to the ten sefirot. That is, the heavenly spheres which are conduits of God's transcendent presence into the earth. So it's the vessels by which God becomes immanent within the universe.
And do then acts of human creation emanate out towards these circles, or?
Well, human acts of loving kindness and goodness can broaden these vessels of God's energy into the world. So a particular kind of good act may stimulate a particular heavenly sphere or sphira, and it can lead to a greater level of God's immanence in a particular aspect of life.
Mm. And Dr. Jalas, if I'm not mistaken, isn't the Islamic understanding of the creation of the world also based in language? That the first thing God created was the pen?
That the first thing that God created was the pen? I think before the pen, one must create the paper and the ink, and then later the pen.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, there's an historical argument within Islamic theologians about whether God created the Quran or whether the Quran created God.
There is this discussion, it's very old, which is that it's bizarre, but the discussion was something like this. Either the Quran is fallible, that is perfect, or it is imperfect. And if the Quran is perfect, then it is worthy of worship. And if it is... No, wait a minute. Either the Quran is uncreated or it is created. And if the Quran is uncreated, then...
It's co-eternal with God.
Which means it's worthy of worship. And if it is created, then it may be fallible.
It seems that either way, you're in trouble.
There seems to be it's problematic.
Which is something
there.
We can probably generalize about life in general. Either way, you're in trouble.
There are problems. Well, let's share our number. So it's 617-253-8810 if anyone would like to call in and join us in our and invent new words with us. Caller, welcome to the air. Caller?
This might be... Oh, here we go.
Hello, caller.
Hello?
Yes, marhaban. Caller?
This is probably a very neologistical caller.
Well, I think it may be a good point in the program.
Yes, hi.
Yes, caller.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, is this Ivan the Mellow? Caller.
You know, sometimes I find it very hard to reach people even when they're in front of me, and this kind of difficulty becomes infinitely greater when the person's not in front of you and you want to reach them and make a connection.
Yeah, sometimes the connection is easier when they are further away.
Yes, this is Ivan Zanello calling from Tokyo, Japan.
From Tokyo, wow.
Ivan, I think we have a great vast delay between what we say and what when we hear what you say.
I think this is what we can call proximicity.
Proximicity.
We can feel them proximally, but there is some delay, a deferral, not only of meaning, but of the actual sound.
Of the experience.
If you like.
Yes, we do, unfortunately. There is already great time lag between our continents.
It sounds like there's a blizzard going on in the background, too.
I think we should continue our conversation and then bring Ivan in periodically. No sense in us waiting, that is to say, for a response. We should continue.
Right, we were talking about human language and its relation to...
This is the air conditioner.
Not a sandstorm nor a hurricane, but an air conditioner.
And it's wonderful to imagine that different parts of one's mind may have this sort of similar delay in them, you know. I find that I experience delays in my body all the time, aside from the obvious delays of consuming and then a long delay and then, you know, excreting. But similarly, we have delays such as when I eat a chocolate bar, I get immediately a sugar rush. I feel very energetic and alive and wonderful. And particularly if I was very hungry. And then almost immediately I feel an intense low. I feel hungrier and more energyless than I was before the sugar. And it is this sort of, you know, the medical experts will describe this as coming from a delay, that the body is producing hormones to consume sugar, but, and it is the sugar, the presence of a great amount of sugar, which triggers this, but because of the delay, it overproduces this hormone, and the result is that we experience a sugar low.
Well, this is the logic of capitalism, that low makes you want another high.
Hmm.
And so we are riding this kind of roller coaster of consumerism.
So we could say that sugar is the opiate of the masses, maybe?
I think it's certainly one of them. It's been mass-produced in such a way that allows it to be distributed en masse.
Hmm.
And it appeals widely into the most base of the senses. It's not... It does nothing to provoke critique.
What, even refined sugar? Because I find... Yes, we have a caller?
Yeah, we once again, we throw out the number, and after some delay, we have two callers. Caller, welcome to the air.
Namaste.
Oh, marhaban. Namaste. Marhaban.
Arthur here.
It is Arthur. Welcome, Mr. Beam.
Yeah, great to be here. I heard this really fascinating story about going to the bathroom in space.
Oh, well, do share it with us.
Yeah, it's the way that I heard it. The way I heard it was kind of like an astronaut would talk, very technical, scientific, you know, describing how urine comes out of the body and it's sterile, whereas solid waste is much more troubling.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has bacteria and all kinds of things that constitute the biohazard.
Mm-hmm.
And he described just how difficult it was. It's kind of, if you imagine a toothpaste bottle, you know, squeezing that out in space, what happens? It just, the taste squeezes out and it doesn't really go anywhere. And if you lose control of the paste, it's a biohazard. It just got me thinking about the human body in a different way, how it's weird how you take something external and combine it with the human body. And then if you put that back inside the body, you know, it can be sick, can be toxic or fatal. I think another way to look at it is if you take something from the lower part of your body, like your intestines, and you combine that with an upper part, that is really the problem. That kind of...
And maybe that's why there's that delay between the one and the other. Let's bring another voice in to share this delay.
Yeah, it's not easy Hello. Yes, for an astronaut to come out and say it like that.
Caller 2, welcome to the air.
Yes, hi. This is Ivan joining you from Tokyo via a direct line.
Welcome back, Ivan.
Thank you. And so this is a red telephone. It's a direct connection, and it's a collect call. I hope you don't mind.
Well, I'm sure the station will be happy to contribute.
Well, going back to what Arthur was talking about, this separation of the upper and the lower body, I believe this is an idea that goes back to the Zoroastrian religion, which believes that there's two forces in the world, that of good and that of evil, and the human body actually has both contained within it. And the separation between these parts of the human body, the good and the bad, is actually the human diaphragm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the diaphragm separates the respiratory and the cardiovascular and the brain from the sexually reproductive and the digestive.
And the lungs,
I think that there's a distinction to be made here between the digestive and the reproductive. I would not say that the GI tract is actually a part of the body. It's not inside, but it is actually an outside that happens to be completely encased by the inside. And so to say that that is, when you swallow something, that that's then inside your body, it's not really inside your body. It's inside your body the way I am inside this room, but I am not inside the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't the sphincter kind of an airlock? I mean,
it may be like an airlock, but it's not.
But you're
there are still membranes that are, they may be permeable, but they're not completely permeable. So
okay,
I think
your esophagus isn't really inside either.
Correct. Or, you know, what is inside the esophagus? Yes.
Something really interesting about that is that two-dimensional creatures, you know, like a king on a playing card, can't have esophaguses. You know, that connect all the way through to the anus. They'd actually fall in half.
Yeah, that's a very apt description. But analogously, we are, and I think this has come up on the program multiple times, is that we are tubes. And I actually think that this fasting is a great way for a person to celebrate their emptiness.
I like to think of the human body as more of a donut, in that there's this skin all around the outside, which also includes this hole through the middle.
Mm.
And that if you imagine a donut and were to knead it into a shape that is a bit more complex, that has arms and legs, then that would essentially be the human body.
Well, it's interesting because some people prefer the donut hole to the donut. I wonder if those represent the people who don't actually like other human beings and prefer the emptiness.
Well, according to our chronometers here, the time of sunset has been reached, although it is advised by many scholars to wait 3 minutes to allow for any error in the timepieces before breaking fast.
Now, I, of course, am a Jewish professor, but being a New Age practitioner, I believe in accepting and embracing aspects of all religions. So I actually fast approximately 223 days of the year. I take the union of all fast days of all religions, and I accept them. So I, too, am fasting today.
But that makes a lot of sense.
Unfortunately, there is an obscure Indonesian fasting holiday which begins at sundown, so I have to fast for a full 24 hours.
Fortunately, this Indonesian holiday does not extend for the entire month.
No, it's just for the next 3 days.
So, I would like to cut in. I'm actually on an anti-fast. I'm actually right now gorging myself in Japanese restaurants for about a period of a week. And it's also part of my religious awakening, my spiritual walk, so to speak, into the realm of of Shinto Buddhism, and it's quite an interesting experience to be able to partake in the rich gastro enterological explorations of various dives in Tokyo and Kyoto.
Now, Ivan, is a funnel involved in this consumption, or is it just the, using the traditional mini shovel implements that are common here in the West?
I'm sorry, I'm experiencing static, but what I do here is that you alluded to this orgiastic ritual on my part, and this is part of the initiation procedure.
The initiation procedure?
Yes.
Into the Japanese culture.
As part of the neo-Buddhist tradition, which is mixed in with old Russian Orthodox ways, this gorging festival lasts for a week, and it allows you to actually kind of cleanse your spiritual palate.
It's funny, we were talking earlier about the connection between language and the essence of the universe. And now we're talking about fasting, and we can actually combine these topics.
Many
New Age practitioners have advocated silence fasts. So fasts where instead of refraining from food, we refrain from speech.
Well, I think the hosts now will take a moment to break fast. So we'll all return in a few moments.
Gentlemen, I need to hop into an underground tube.
Well,
going to work my cashier shift.
Well, thank you, Arthur, for joining us. However,
always a pleasure, fellas.
Masarama.
Bulibanji. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, we're back on the air now. Let's bring in another caller. Caller, welcome.
Thank you. This is Ivan.
Ivan, welcome back.
Thank you. This music is heaven. I feel myself ascending on Mount Fuji. And almost levitating up of the deep of the mountain.
Well, there are those who say that upon death we all enter a fiery realm which seems at first glance to resemble hell. And we may be suffering for some time. And the truth of the matter is that only those who realize that this is actually heaven are those who feel that they are in heaven.
Now, we were listening to Dean Evanson, his Portal Through the Mind. So it's not at all ironic that we might feel this sensation. And now we are listening to Andreas Vollenweider's Cosmopoly. And Ivan, so what brought you to the Ainu tribes in Japan?
It's interesting that you ask. So I've had a long-standing culinary disagreement with certain former members of the Culinary Institute of America. Because they happen to believe that there are only three kinds of sauces: the Russian dressing, the Texas Ranch sauce, and the Asian dressing. And unfortunately, I feel this is not the case. And I decided to try to cleanse my spiritual palate and try to ascertain if there are certain other kinds of sauces that are present on different continents, and Japan is one of the I think prime examples of
different sauces.
Type of cuisine. Yeah.
Well, there's the house special sauce, of course, too.
Yes, and actually some of these members of the probably former members of the Culinary Institute of America have been putting microdoses of a special sauce into my food in the past couple of years, and I have a very bad allergic reaction to this special sauce. So I decided to kind of again cleanse my spiritual palate and see if I can bask in the springs and try to kind of purge the special sauce that I've been fed
now,
for the last...
Ivan, yeah. Of course, we all must allow that there are certainly a finite number of sauces, because the analogy of the sauces in the human body are the various fluids that are there, and certainly
yes,
there are only a finite number, the various
of course we know that
humors,
the humors
and biles.
Yes, the humors and the biles, they form the essence of our spiritual individuality.
Now, I do wonder if each sauce in its prime form corresponds linearly with some humor.
I'm not sure if there is a linear relationship. I would argue for a highly non-linear function with multiple discontinuities.
But like, for instance, the core of the Texas Ranch dressing, which is Texan beets, probably I would think corresponds to the aqueous humor.
Mm.
And the chocolate, which is the basis of the mole sauce, probably corresponds with the dark bile.
Well, I've heard it claimed that ketchup, in its modern American formulation, represents what's called a perfect food. The meaning being that no alteration of its ingredients could improve upon its taste. That
so it's a Nash, like a local maximum.
A local maximum, yes. And it achieves some perfect level of balance between those ingredients.
I've heard similar statements made about crocodiles. There is some evidence that they have not evolved in many, many centuries, suggesting that they have reached a peak level of evolutionary sophistication.
And there are some sects, I believe, who try to fashion their behavior in a way to imitate the crocodile.
Which is certainly a very challenging thing.
And a bit strange, I think.
I think that it's never appropriate to assume that we have achieved a state of evolution or perfection of evolution, that there have been many failed projects in human history in which people have said, we are the final solution, we are the city on the hill, we are the model for the future because we have achieved everything that the past has led up to, and this is the conclusion. And that is a very dangerous statement to make, and has in all cases led to failure. And so I think that it's most likely that if there is such a thing as a perfection or a state of perfection or a stopping point, end of human history, that when it is obtained, it will not be done by announcing it.
Well, my personal religious belief is that the universe as we know it is nothing more than a cosmic joke, you might say. I mean, I believe that our existence is essentially a rough draft, you might say, for a more perfect existence. And this rough draft was forgotten about by its creators and left to run aground on its own, and will continue working on this rough draft until it runs into oblivion.
Well, you know, there are two ways of regarding this kind of belief. On the one hand, it seems desolate, like this idea that we were abandoned and forgotten by our creators. But on the other hand, it gives a lot of meaning to the effort that we put into perfecting what was given to us as imperfect. And so,
I think sometimes manifestations of the divine being are actually presented, and we do come upon such instances. Like, for example, yesterday I had a brief chance encounter with a geisha, and that lovely evening really amounted to me transcending the heights of spiritual ecstasy.
So it renewed your faith.
Yes, it did.
That's a beautiful story.
Another thing that this makes me think of, this personal philosophy held by Professor Levine, is that it invalidates a lot of the complaints that we hear. I find that I have a habit of complaining frequently, and if I think to myself, well, you know, it's an imperfect world and it will be replaced by version 2, or maybe has already been done in a parallel existence, then maybe I shouldn't be complaining so much. And I spent once a year trying to reduce the amount of complaints that I made. So
do you really want to upgrade to version 2.0? Because there might be a lot of bugs.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. It's one of these risks. But in any case, I spent a year working on reducing my complaint level by adding weights onto the ends of the mustache every time I complained, every time I caught myself in a complaint. And I figured that at the end of the year, I would have stopped complaining out of pain in my under nose region. But instead, I have now a very, very large mustache.
And upper lip in general.
I have a similar approach
only I eat a donut each time that I have a complaint, and you might have noticed that I have gained considerable weight.
Well, Ivan, I need no assistance with my girth. I realize the lesson from this is that some level of complaining is necessary. There is no sense in trying to defeat one's own biology.
I think that the distinction to be drawn is between complaints that are merely backbiting or frivolity and those that are productive criticism that can help improve awareness and encourage better understanding and healing and perhaps revolution. That if I would say that in my philosophy, every system contains within it the seed of its own destruction, and that is not something to be mourned or lamented, but celebrated and cultivated. So seeking out these seeds and cultivating them, that's the project of humanity.
Mm. Well, I agree, because Marxian, actually, dialectic dictates that in order to push the course of progress, we have to have again this dialectical process. And so I believe that actually we have to complain constantly, because that in and of itself brings the yang on the opposite side, so to speak, of enlightenment and spiritual awareness.
Yes, and I think the fact that our universe is a sick cosmic joke, which is being ignored and running aground, actually lends our existence a certain kind of tragic beauty. We all know that one of the forms of beauty is tragedy and sadness. And I think it's a gift to humankind that we can experience this on a, you know, almost continuous basis, this tragedy and sadness. And one of the lessons of the New Age is not to get rid of our complaints, not to stop complaining and to stop crying, but rather to experience them as authentic beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the lesson from this is not how we should look at the world or whether or not we should experience it with contempt. This information does not tell us how we should regard our own existence. It merely tells us more about it and gives us a new way to appreciate it.
It gives us the backdrop to our life. But we can still achieve enlightenment against that backdrop of meaninglessness. This music I happen to find very enlightening also.
Well, we are listening again to another track from Andreas Vollenweider's Cosmopoly album. This track is called El Shell.
This is the kind of music that I would imagine a guru would square dance to.
That's a beautiful image. My own square dancing past involves calling square dances with an interesting fellow who taught me everything that I know about square dancing. When I first came to this country, I met him actually in Times Square, and he was an older gentleman. He died a few years ago. He's passed away. But at the time, he had retired from being a physical educator. And educating people in the physical form, and when he had done his requisite time in the public system, he had taken his pension and decided that he wanted to do something else involving the movement of bodies and the corralling of humans, and so he decided to become a square dance caller. And I believe that an incentive was also that he wanted to go on many free cruises across the Atlantic, and that to do that one can be perhaps a magician or a ship captain or, of course, a square dance caller.
Yes, and of course the way a guru does the square dance is that he'll start with a circle, square the circle, and then achieve the square dance.
Mm-hmm.
Can a guru square dance on his own by allowing his mind to play all the different parts in the square?
I've never seen that actually achieved, although it is purported to be the end result of a long spiritual process in many of the guidebooks.
The dervish, as it were, whirling about, not circularly, but squarularly.
And instantaneously playing all the roles through some feat of bending the very existence of space.
Or perhaps there is a simpler path to this experience. Perhaps each of the limbs must simultaneously instruct the mind instead of being so carefully controlled.
That's interesting, because normally, of course, our brain instructs our limbs. You're suggesting that the limbs instead should instruct the mind.
Although, you know, one thing I've often wondered is, we regard the brain as sitting solely within our heads, but really there is nerve tissue throughout the body. Would it be so surprising if there were really knowledge or memory in one's fingers?
I think there's certainly a lot more to the nervous system than most lay people really give credit to. I think it's also in thinking about how the extremities may instruct the mind, or the mind is dependent on the big toe, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I am reminded of the, I believe it is called suspension syndrome, in which if someone is suspended in the air for some amount of time vertically with the head above the feet, that the blood will go down to the feet as it normally does, but then because one is not walking around and creating muscular activity that would move the allow the veins to push the blood back up to the brain, that someone will lose consciousness. The blood will remain in the feet and stay there. And this is what they call suspension syndrome. So indeed, the brain is reliant upon the feet.
Is it similar to crucifixion?
I would imagine that would be one of the discomforts of crucifixion, yes.
Actually, I have a feedback loop going on between my brain and my belly button. So,
That is to say, you push your belly button, and then when the information reaches your brain that the bully button has been pressed, you return and press it again with more intensity.
I try to temper this cycle.
Well, it's a dangerous one.
It's interesting. This reminds me of a study that was done on blind people. So the scientists took these people who had been blind from birth, and they installed an elaborate series of needles on their back, which would essentially simulate a computer screen. Each needle would be a pixel on the screen.
A raster.
Yeah. And they fed into this needle array a feed from a video camera that the subject wore upon his eyes. And essentially he was able to experience some simulacrum of vision through these needles, and he was able to navigate and walk. And then, to further test this contraption, the scientists displayed naked women in front of the video camera, and they found that the subjects had no feelings of arousal from this series of pins in their back.
Strange. Actually, there is a well-known combination of sushi and sashimi, which acts in a synesthetic way to also bring about this image of a beautiful geisha clad in her robes and dancing. And this interplay between the colors of the palette, so to speak, is something to I would really recommend you to experience.
Mm-hmm. And it's said that some Japanese businessmen actually prefer this simulated geisha experience to the real geisha experience. It's somehow lighter and more subtle.
But it really speaks to the flexibility of the mind, and also the danger to which we expose ourselves to various stimuli, because all of the complaining that we do has an unknown effect on our various humors, you know, and it's not at all, it should not be surprising that stress and general unhappiness or an unhappy outlook of on life causes many physical manifestations.
Well, I think it's a dynamic equilibrium, and people have different parameter settings, and it is all a matter of individual differences.
Mm. Well, Ivan, unfortunately, we are reaching the end of the hour.
Спасибо, and
you're welcome.
Thank you.
مع السلامة. مع السلامة. Also to my two co-hosts this evening, Professor Levine.
Great to be here again.
And Frau Dr. Zina van Hoechen.
Solidarity.
I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here with Music for Humans. Music for Humans is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you. We are here every Friday at 7 p.m. on WMBR 88.1 FM. Stay tuned for Hidden Gems in Plain Sight. Ma'a salama.
Safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Thank you.